This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Right, brains on, good. Ears open, amazing. Jaws ready to be dropped in amazement. Fantastic, let's do it. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan, cheers for giving us a listen. This is where we take a sneak peek inside the secrets of the universe. Now this week we learn why animals' blood can be strange colours, not just red. Also we talk about the stars that are in the sky and how you can get a better look at them. And we'll hear about one of the most brutal beasts in Asia. First, let's catch up then with our alien best mates, N and G. They're here every week and they still haven't got back home.
N and G's Meet a Motivator.
So guys, you know all about energy, right?
No, we are energy.
As you know, I'm trying to be a meter motivator. That means coming up with ideas about how to save energy and prevent waste. So, got any tips?
Of course. You earthlings slurp up energy all over your shiny homes. Sometimes you don't even know you're doing it.
If you're not using a room, turn off the lights. And make sure you're using energy-efficient light bulbs. They use less electricity and they'll last a lot longer too.
And when you're not using a room for a period of time, like a back bedroom, turn off the radiators and keep the curtains closed. No point heating and lighting it for the spiders.
In fact, closing the curtains is a really good way to keep the heat on the inside. If you haven't got curtains, maybe get some or make some.
Keeping clean is super important. Just think about the energy you use. Have a shower, not a bath. It uses a lot less energy and water. You can even time yourself to reduce your usage even more. Can you wash from head to foot in under 4 minutes? Give it a try.
But don't forget to wash behind your ears and check your washing machine to see if it has shorter, cooler cycles. Modern washing liquids work well at lower temperatures, and unless things are really mucky, they won't need washing for hours.
And the top tip of all, watch your smart meter energy display. Keep an eye on what you're spending on gas and electricity as you go along. It'll remind you to try out energy-saving techniques. And you'll notice if you've accidentally left something switched on.
That's brilliant. Thanks, guys.
And thanks for being a marvellous meter motivator, kid.
Watch out. Looks like we're gonna fuse, G. Time for us to pop.
Here it comes, whoopee! I love a bit of fusion. See ya, kid.
Bye, N and G. And thanks.
Here it comes.
Find out how you can be a meter motivator with N and G. With support from Smart Energy GB. Find out more at funkidslive.com/energy.
Remember, if you've got any science question rattling around your brain that you need the answer to, tell me what it is. Leave it as a review over on Apple Podcasts. I'll see it. I'll either get a proper genius in that field to sort it out for you, or I'll do all the research and explain it. You need to leave it first as a review over on Apple Podcasts. That's what Leo and Tara have done. They're in the UAE, and they ask what a non-Newtonian fluid is. Now, that's a fluid that doesn't follow Isaac Newton's law of viscosity. And that law is of constant thickness, independent of stress or pressure, pretty much. So a non-Newtonian fluid is, it's a liquid, a fluid that you can change the thickness of, like ketchup. That's a good example, because it'll sit there for ages and it'll get thick and stodgy, but then you can shake it to make it runnier, can't you? It's the same with custard, with honey, with toothpaste. They're all non-Newtonian fluids because you can change their viscosity by putting them under some pressure. Also, let's see, hello to Lucy Newsome. Hey, Lucy, who asks, why can animals' blood be sometimes blue? Lucy, it's all to do with what's in the blood. You see, ours is red because of a protein called hemoglobin. It binds oxygen together so that the oxygen can go into the blood and it can be taken around your body and can be used. The structure of hemoglobin as a molecule gives it that red colour. But some animals, they've got different colours of blood. Spiders, mollusks, octopuses, they've got blue blood because of something called hemocyanin. Ours contains iron, theirs contains copper, and that turns their blood blue. Some worms, they've got green blood because of a molecule called chlorocruorin, and other marine worms have got purple blood because of hemerythrin. And that's it. That's the different colours of blood, thankfully. All those complex molecules for me to pronounce are done with. It's just quite easy to get your head around when you think of it like that. The colour of blood is determined by the molecules and the proteins that the cells carry. And if you've got a science question that you want answered on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, you need to find us over on Apple Podcasts and leave it as a review. Now, there's a stunning book that's just come out. It's called Ocean, Secrets of the Deep. And it tries to explore the part of the sea that we do know, but also the 90-odd percent of the ocean that we have no clue about. Like, imagine that. Imagining we only really know what's going on in the top 5 or 10% of the sea. Now, the author of the book is Sabrina Weiss, and she's here in the studio on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Sabrina, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, I think the first question, what's the most amazing animal that I could learn about inside these pages?
Inside these pages, yes. So I am totally amazed by the amazing whales that we have featured in that book as well. I mean, imagine swimming in the ocean and coming across a 40-ton animal that's about the size of 15 metres or so. It's a bit scary, you'd think, but actually they're so gentle, and if you're lucky, they might approach you and just inspect you a little bit as well because they're very curious.
So as well as the whales, what's the most amazing bit of research that you found out whilst making this book, whilst writing it? Something that you didn't know that you came across while putting this together?
Yeah, there were lots of facts that we came across when putting it together, but there was one bit actually when I was chatting to Julia, the Amicis, who illustrated the book. She was talking about the grouper and moray eel that were found to hunt together. So I've seen those two animals swim or just relax in crevices in coral reefs when I went diving myself, but I hadn't known that they were hunting together. So basically, if a grouper spots some fish hidden in some of the crevices in the coral reefs and they know they're not able to really go through there and reach those fish, they might actually go find a moray eel who, with its snaky body, can go through those crevices and push the fish out. And so they're working together, and at the end, both of them get a meal.
So how do they work together? Because they're not speaking, they're not chatting like we are right now. How are they figuring this thing out?
Exactly. So it seems like the grouper basically just swims past the moray eel that is just chilling, relaxing all day because they don't really leave the reef during the day, and just starts shaking its body, kind of trying to get the moray eel's attention. And then it would go to where the fish supposedly are and kind of do a handstand. So you kind of move upside down and shake its head to point towards where the fish are. And that is a sign, and that's how it explains to the moray eel where to find them.
I said in the start when I was introducing you that we know almost nothing about the oceans. It's how did you find out the things that you did know that I can read in the book? Because it's such a tough place to research because it's so much of it is inhabitable, really.
It is, yeah. And I thought actually before researching and writing the book, I thought I knew a lot. But it was when we were looking for different science articles and existing books, that's when we really came across some of the facts that we had never heard of. And it was particularly when we were putting together the deep seas chapter, which you're looking at the moment, is that I hardly knew any of those species. I knew that there were some sort of fierce and weird looking ones down there, but I obviously hadn't seen them myself because they're just way too deep to see them with our own eyes.
Now, this is, I mean, it's not really a question, but this is amazing. So the deepest recorded free dive is, I mean, it's 100 or so metres above the deepest dive with air supply. It's 253 odd metres. Someone's dived into the water without any assistance. Is that right? That's crazy.
Well, you have some assistance and a lot of training, so don't try to do it yourself without the training.
And so how did you get the idea for the book? Because I know that you are a scuba diver yourself. You've scuba dived since you were young. How did that all come together for you to make the book?
So a couple of years ago, I was working in Mozambique for a marine research charity. And that's actually where I met Julia, who illustrated the book. And at the time, she had already been illustrating a couple of books. And that's when the idea for that book came about. And we just decided to, because we were working there together and decided to put that book together. So that's how the project started.
And then what happened? How did you research this? I know you said that you were looking through articles and you're reading a lot of stuff around the creatures that we see in the story. Did you get in the water to do some research yourself?
When it started, I was still in Mozambique, so I had kind of already thought about some of the fish that we might feature in there. As you said, we've been reading loads, and it was also around the time when Blue Planet 2 came out, so we obviously got quite a bit of inspiration from there too.
And how were you working with Julia, the illustrator? Because obviously your research and the facts and the words in this are stunning, but half of it is... It's just incredible pictures. It really is just utterly mind-blowing, the thing that you've put together. How did you kind of work together to put this together?
Yeah, it was very important to pick animals and plants even that would work visually, because obviously it's a visual book with lots of illustrations and infographics. So when we were going through the sort of list of species and looking at some of the facts, we really had to pick the ones that we knew could work well visually, because some of the... bacteria or tiny little fish or crustaceans, they're just too small to illustrate. So unfortunately, we weren't able to feature all of them.
And you, as a scuba diver, can you tell us about some of the creatures that you've met under the water properly face to face?
Yes, lots of them. Yeah, so I've been diving since the age of 11 or so, and I've been to quite a few places, but primarily to tropical waters because that's just what I prefer. I've come across dolphins, sharks, whale sharks even, but also some smaller animals, so smaller fish, little shrimps, the moray eel as well that are just sort of hidden within the reefs. Lots of colourful animals, and sometimes I've been quite lucky for them to approach me as well, which is quite exciting. So if you do leave them some space, they might come up to you. And inspect you.
What about, you mentioned being with sharks. Do you ever get a sense when you're around some of these creatures, and especially sharks, as this is their world, that perhaps you are intruding almost? Do you kind of get a feel from them that they're feeling a bit protective about, and there's a human in their lair? How do you kind of interact with these creatures while you are down there?
I think what is always important when swimming or diving, and it's the same when you're on land looking at animals, is just to give them, just keep a distance and give them their space. And if you do that, they might take the initiative and come up to you. So now with sharks, I found that they're actually quite shy. So whenever I did see them, it would have been from quite a distance, so they would kind of circle around the group, but sort of keep 5 meters or so distance. It was only on the surface when I came across whale sharks, which are just feeding and gulping in lots of water to filter through and eat plankton. That's when I got really close, because they're just so hungry, they don't really care about you and probably don't notice you at all.
So the book is Secrets of the Deep. Apart from a few that you've already told us about at the start, what other secrets can we find out, can we uncover by reading the book?
Lots of secrets, and probably still not all of them. But yeah, there's some interesting sections looking at history of our oceans. So for instance, looking at some of the legends. So one of my favourite examples is the manatees, which are just really odd looking, slow swimming animals that actually, it seems, according to history books, are the animals that inspired the mermaid tales, because they, from far away, obviously if you're on a boat and you see something moving about, it might look like that. So that's something that we came across, and yeah, I got to see for myself a year or so ago, and they're just really gentle and sweet animals, very passive, so they just kind of swim around, but they might approach you as well if you're lucky.
There's a big culture at the moment. People are being quite watchful about the oceans. I think we're finally figuring out that we need to take care. You know, there's better thought going into what we're doing with plastics after Blue Planet and things like that. How do you see that going? Do you as someone who knows the sea well, do you see us saving it? Or is there a chance that, this is quite a bleak way to end, that we may have affected it forever?
I'm actually quite positive, or let's say optimistic about it. I mean, obviously, our actions are having an impact. And I think what I've learned over the years is that you don't actually need to live by the ocean for your actions to have an impact. So even if you're, so like myself, I grew up in Switzerland, so in a country that just doesn't have any access to the ocean. But it's just all interlinked, and obviously rivers flow into the ocean. So even if you are in a country like that, if you leave trash in a river, that might end up in an ocean at some point. But I found that nowadays, or particularly in the last couple of years, people have become well more aware of how they're impacting the ocean. And I think that it's with the awareness where change starts, and that's when people really start caring about it. So I think people can make a difference, even if it's just little by little.
Fantastic. Sabrina, the book is absolutely stunning. It's Ocean, Secrets of the Deep by Sabrina Weiss. Honestly, it's such a beautiful book, and you learn so much, literally, Secrets of the Deep. Thank you, Sabrina. Thank you for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where today we're meeting one of the most brutal beasts in Asia. The wet Indonesian archipelago, it holds the closest thing that we have to a real, proper dragon. The Komodo dragon is the largest lizard on Earth. Actually, I think we can do better than this music, you know, to describe it. Such a powerful monster. I think it needs something more fitting. Hang on a sec. There we go. The Komodo dragon is over 3 meters long, it weighs in at 350 pounds, and it can travel up to 13 miles an hour. Right, thanks, Rocky. I think we'll go back to what we were with. It's got powerful claws, it's got a strong jaw, it's got sharp teeth, it's got armoured scales, its mouth is lined with toxic venom, and one bite can lead to serious infection, with the possibility that a limb needs to be amputated, completely cut off. It feasts on buffalo, birds, small mammals, and snakes. Now, they just because they don't eat humans, doesn't mean that they won't eat humans. If they see you, and if they think that they can take you, you may just make the perfect meal, you know. And they look terrifying. Have you seen a Komodo dragon? Stalking around the ground, thrashing the tail. It's got this hissing, spitting, writhing tongue. It's just one of the closest thing we have to a real-life mythological dragon. The Komodo absolutely earns its place on our Dangerous Dan list. Let's get some of your gadget questions answered with another episode of Techno Mum.
Techno Mum, engineering explorers.
It's the swimming gala today. Pity I came second to last in my race. I wish I was as fast as my friend Ryan. He can clear one whole length in 30 seconds. I think he's secretly a dolphin.
Hey, why so sad? I thought you did brilliantly.
Nice try, Mum. I was terrible. What I need is someone to invent turbo flippers. Or, I don't know, underwater rocket blasters.
So what you need is a marine engineer.
A marine engineer?
Marine engineers design and build things which will operate in water. So that might mean at sea, in a river or reservoir, even in a swimming pool. One of the oldest types of marine engineering is naval architecture. That's designing watercraft.
Watercraft? You mean boats, right?
There's more to watercraft than boats. For starters, boats come in all shapes and sizes, from a small dinghy to a huge cargo ship. And then there are submarines and exploration vessels which travel to the deepest depths of the sea.
And don't forget the turbo flippers.
Naval architects will figure out the best way for these vessels to be propelled, which means thinking about power and engine design. Watercraft need to be able to change directions and stop, so naval architects will design steering systems and understand how anchors work. They also need to make sure that the vessels are safe and comfortable places in which people can travel and work. Things can behave very differently at sea, so they need to have studied hard to learn the effect that water has on machinery and materials.
Yeah, no one wants a rusty boat.
Then you've got the oceanic engineers. Oceanography is the study of oceans themselves, including things which live in them. Scientists in this field use lots of equipment to gather and analyse samples and take readings. That equipment has to be able to cope with the demands of a watery workplace, and marine engineers are the experts.
Cool! Imagine you could travel to the bottom of Loch Ness and find the monster.
And in case you think marine engineering is just bobbing around in boats or slipping into underground caves, check out this video. This is the Royal Navy's Griffon hovercraft. It's used in combat and for search and rescue missions. As you can imagine, it's a really complex vessel, and learning to operate it can take months.
Yeah, You wouldn't want to crash that by accident.
Well, this is where engineers have put their heads together. Software engineers at Birmingham University have been working with marine engineers to capture video from the hovercraft as it carries out its duties. This is then used in virtual reality simulators back on dry land to help train people up before they get on board.
You see, if I had one of those, I'd definitely have beaten Ryan in the freestyle.
And been disqualified.
Cool job, though.
It's just one of loads of cool jobs in engineering.
Engineering Explorers, created with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology to celebrate the Year of Engineering. Find out more at funkislive.com/technomum.
Let's talk about all the science that has been in your news this week. The Japanese Hayabusa 2 spacecraft is due to detonate a bomb on the asteroid that it's exploring. It's meant to make a crater in the rock Ryugu, which it can drop into to collect samples of the asteroid that haven't been exposed to space. Hayabusa, it's been on the rock since June last year, and this is a big deal. Also, a severely wounded rescue seal found near Norfolk in the UK has been named after Sir David Attenborough. It was found with a plastic ring stuck around its neck and it struggled to breathe. Now they managed to set it free. Good news, and they've named it after Attenborough after the awareness that Sir David has raised to the plight of plastic in the ocean. And finally, tracking aeroplanes anywhere on the planet has now got easier. A US firm called Aerion has made a new satellite surveillance network that's now live and it can track any plane's position, altitude, direction, and speed every 8 seconds. It employs a constellation of 66 spacecrafts hanging above the atmosphere, which monitor the messages given out by aircrafts. So they've got like this constant map of where everything is. Brilliant idea. Yes, fantastic science in the news. That is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. If you've got a question that you want answered on the show, you need to head over to Apple Podcasts, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, and leave it as a review. While you're there, also, it's a brilliant place that you can find all our amazing science series that we do on Fun Kids. You've heard some today. We've got loads more. They're all on Apple Podcasts and on every other podcast place as well. Places like Spotify. It's also on the free Fun Kids app. You can hear them at funkidslive.com. And we're a kids radio station from the UK. You can hear Fun Kids all around the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.